Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome, everybody, to the Creating Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. My name is Lauren Wells. I am joined by my co-host today, Chris Seveny. This podcast is actually a live podcast. So if you're listening to this, the recorded version of this, feel free to follow us a little bit. Sometimes we host live episodes, invite people to listen in live and see how it really goes down behind the scenes. It's pretty much the same with maybe a few edits here and there when I lose my train of thought. That being said, we are going to talk today about protecting your investment in a down market, specifically starting with how is this recession that we're heading into or in, how will it compare to 07, 08? What is 7E doing to take advantage of the current economic environment and climate? And what are we hearing from the industry? What am I hearing from investors? And yeah, now that I've spoken a bunch, Chris, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you? The one difference is we get it right the first time on our live podcasts. On our recorded podcast, we may go through three or four takes before we get the intro correct. And it's typically my fault. But so that's why I just sit nice and quietly while we get rolling. So it's good to be here today.
Yeah, usually we do record the intro like four times because I can't get it right or it doesn't sound great. So it is what it is today. You all heard it here live. This is what we'll be going with. To start off today's podcast episode, let's talk about the two things we could kick it off with. But let's start with the biggest thing, you know, I'm being asked is, you know, we're hearing from both the industry and then I'm hearing a lot on my calls, many people are forecasting or anticipating a decline in the housing prices, valuations, which obviously it's impossible to predict. None of us have this like crystal ball. What are we seeing? What are we expecting? And how are we addressing it at 7E when it comes to the assets that we're investing in?
Would you like me start?
Yes, no. That's for you.
So a few things, like when people ask me that question, that come to mind. And a lot of people will gravitate towards 2007-08, which is the most recent downturn. I was also part of 2000-2001 timeframe where I was several years out of college.
Aging yourself here.
Hey, that's okay. But what was similar with that is that was a tech bubble that popped. And you're starting to see that occur, I think, right now is on the tech side of things. A lot of the layoffs, rates were higher back then. So also there was differences on loan originations, which we're seeing a lot of that drive it. The difference today versus kind of the others, or 2007, we did have that ramp up in home prices as well, like we did with COVID. I think we don't have that crystal ball like you mentioned, but I think we all should be wise enough to realize housing can't sustain the current growth that it's at. And there's probably going to be some softening in the housing market. And one of the interesting things, because being an engineer and an analytics guy, I go back and looked at the downturns. And I think you do some research too. Back in 2007-08, do you recall what the overall price depreciation was during that time of homes, so to speak?
Yeah, we've been talking about this. And like you said, we're always tracking the market in relation to where it's been in the past. And the funny part is when we talked about this, I'm talking about how when I speak with investors, before I looked into the actual number, I was like, yeah, if housing prices were to drop 30, 40, 50%, which is what I feel like this, and when I speak with investors, that's what they're thinking. Oh my gosh, you know, excuse my language, shit's really going to hit the fan. Yeah. And that's what we're going to see. Housing prices are going to slash by 50%. But when you look back, it like 07, 08, really, it was like at the max, like 15%. Is that what we saw when we were looking at this, when I was looking into it? It just puts that into perspective. Wow, that it seems like everything was so drastic. And it was, it did impact a lot of people, don't get me wrong, but that's a very big difference when thinking a house at that's valued at like 500,000 is going to drop to 250. That's very different.
And the other component was, it wasn't like overnight. It was a very slow progression. And that's one of the interesting things about housing pricing. And we'll talk about what we do with notes. And one thing I'll just throw a little snippet out right now is we typically will hold a note for around 2 years. You know, the last 2007-08 lasted till 2011-12, which was a four-year turn. I think people thought it was a lot sharper because in certain markets, yes, they did get hit harder. That was overall. But I think also that was the massive amount of job layoffs that were going on during that time. And in today, where there's still, I think, the job market is still very strong. There's certain sectors, again, that are going through some challenges. But so that's an interesting thing because, like you said, a lot of people are predicting, 30, 40%. And how do you protect against that? And protect against anything like that, it's challenging. And for us, if we started out, the foundation is we're always looking to protect investor equity. That is rule number one. I don't care what you're investing in. The sponsor should always be focused on in protecting that investor equity. In mortgage notes, I think one of the benefits is you're backed by real estate. So it is a secured, that is what we invest in compared to other assets. Anyone that turns on the TV right now and looks, here's the term FTX, will definitely know what that means. And one of the interesting things too was like in 2001, I'll hop back a little bit. I was out of college. I had $5,000. So I'm like, I'm going to invest in WorldCom. And WorldCom, you probably don't even know who they are, Lauren. They're basically like a Comcast or Fios where they I think bought in all the AT&T, the Bell companies, and they were like the next basic telecommunications company. And they literally went belly up. And my $5,000 investment literally turned to nothing overnight. And ever since that happened to me, I'm like, okay, real estate, a majority of it, because I can physically see real estate. I can hold it proverbially, like we own the note, but it's secured by something. And that's one of, I think, the first points I'd like to make is during a downturn, investing in something that has some asset behind it is something I'd recommend.
Yeah. And I know this came up in an email the other day that I received about, well, you know, again, what if values drop? We're not buying the actual property. We are buying the note behind it and attached to it. And we're buying that at a discount. I'm sure, Chris, if you want to walk through like an example of how that works, but we're not only, you know, looking at buying property that has equity in it and buying notes that have where the loan balance, where there's equity in the property, but then we're also getting a discount on top of that. We try to stay around 75% loan to value when we're looking at what we purchase. And then also taking, again, that discount off of that. So even if the housing price, the values were to drop, we're pretty buffered in and insulated from that. Now, nothing is guaranteed, obviously, as we will say numerous times. But yeah, that's, I feel like, something to take into account. We're not buying an actual single family home for 70%. And if it drops a little bit, we're like, ooh, we're close. We're buying the loan behind it and at a discount.
Yeah, what I like to use the term investment to value. And a perfect example is, I'll give you two situations of what would you rather be in today. Would you rather originate a brand new loan to somebody that is purchasing a $150,000 home at 20% down? So you're giving them $120,000 at 7% and basically collect roughly, let's say, $800 a month. That's option one, which is basically somebody today going out and getting a mortgage. Or would you rather buy a loan from somebody that originated in 2016 with basically those same terms, but now the loan balance might be 115, 110, 115,000, but also you're buying it at $75,000. So basically your investment to value, let's say the property is worth 150,000 in both situations, your basically investment to value is 50%. Our investment 75%, and then take it another step. And I'll mention numbers so people listening, I apologize that I don't have some visuals. If we hold it for 2 years, 8% to investors is $6,000. So it's $12,000 over 2 years we hold it. So $87,000 is what we'd have to exit that asset at to get the investors their money on a $150,000 investment. So that still is 58%. So there's over 40% coverage on that. Compared to, go back to my other situation, where if you're either lending, private lending, because a lot of people do private lending, and all of a sudden you do get that 15% drop, your risk profile is very different today than it is on that loan compared to buying something that is had some seasoning, even if it is non-performing.
Yeah. And I think that brings up another point. When I'm speaking with people or listening to what people in the market are saying, we have to remember that we're more focused on in our portfolio on assets that were originated pre-COVID. Obviously, COVID, during COVID, we saw tremendous values just skyrocket. Now, if you were to take that away, we're not buying notes that were originated during COVID. The ones we're looking at could have originated like 2010, 2011, even if you were to take away the COVID value, I call it, still have equity. So we're not worried about this value that we've seen over the past 2 years going away, because most of the notes that we're acquiring were acquired or were originated long before COVID came around.
And another component to that is if housing pricing does start to fall, and on basically listening to the Fed, I think one of the comments made is they'd rather break things because they have the tools to fix it than be able to fix something that's not broken. I think they're going to, unemployment will probably rise. So I think they do want to cut some of the jobs as well as soften housing. But typically we're at all-time lows right now on distressed debt. If distressed debt goes up, again, it's a supply-demand business. That loan I just mentioned that we were paying $75,000 for might go down to $60,000. The pricing will also vary based off of market conditions and more inventory. Our prices soften. And by buying it at a discount, it actually gives us more flexibility in most situations, because by buying when we go to work out something with the borrower, because we have a lower cost basis, it actually gives us more flexibility, a little bit more flexibility to still work the numbers to get the return that we target. And a perfect example that I'll illustrate again is if there was a $120,000 loan that was paying $1,000 a month, we bought it at $75,000, they turned around, bought it at $60,000, we'd basically get the same yield having the borrower modify the loan at $800 a month versus $1,000 a month. So it gives us an extra $200 a month, where again, that's for us to negotiate, but it does give us that added flexibility if inventory goes up. Our pricing also goes down, just like in the housing market. As things soften, there's more inventory on the market, we can get better deals.
Yeah, you stole my thunder there. I was going to say it mirrors the market when values go up, costs to acquire and competition gets harder, values come down, our acquisition prices get less, there's more inventory. But to that point of, because we're seeing all this inventory come across our desk, one thing that 7E does when we're evaluating assets is we factor in like pricing decline into our acquisition and our bids. So looking ahead, okay, if there is a decline in value, we're taking that into account upon our initial bid on that asset. And it's something that we're continually, this is our hardened set rule. This is our criteria. We stick to it. We are constantly evolving our bid prices in relationship to what we're seeing on the market, what's happening in the market with value. So that is something, again, that we're taking into account and bringing to our bids.
It's very dynamic and we're very fluid with it, because if I'm looking at a property today in, let's just say, my area of Washington, D.C., pricing is very different here than it is in Phoenix right now. Now, Phoenix is undergoing rapid increase of properties on the market. There are a lot of the iBuyers in that market. So pricing has really started to shoot down in Phoenix. So if there's an asset in Phoenix compared to Washington, D.C., we would look at that very differently on where we anticipate the pricing to be in 24 months. But like you mentioned, we call it price damage. We are including some price appreciation or decline over the next 2 years within our analytics.
Yeah, you summed up what I was going to say. This is one of those parts where I would be like, Tony, can you cut this from the podcast? Right. Lauren lost her train of thought, which usually happens when you say what I was going to say. So
once you start throwing data out there and stuff, I'm like the kid who takes like a whole bag of Doritos.
I know. So I got to be careful.
I want to take all of them.
I can't give you too many data points or else you just run with it.
Yeah.
I guess another thing that, and you touched upon this in a little bit, but talking about how this is different from the 07-08 recession, from what caused it to how it will impact real estate specifically.
Yeah, 07-08, there's a lot of discussions. There's never just one factor that causes any type of recession of that size. But back then, there was a lot of bad loans and fraud going on in the mortgage space, which led to really people being qualified for loans that shouldn't have. I remember I was looking at a house in 2006. And beautiful house. And they were running numbers. It was an interest-only loan they wanted to give us that our payment would have been, start out like $3,000 a month, but then would have jumped to $5,500 a month. And I'm sitting here and they qualified us for a loan. I'm like, wait a second. My take-home pay at the time wasn't $5,500 a month. How can I afford this? Oh, don't worry. You'll be able to afford it. You can refinance, is what they tell you, after in a year. And I'm sitting there, but I can't afford this house. I can't afford this $600,000 mortgage or whatever it was. But unfortunately, I understood that. And a lot of people didn't. And they were just taking those words. So that was really more broad based off of real estate. Today, and again, every downturn has its own issues or its causes. And we've got wars overseas, supply chain issues, COVID, but things are different now because you also have work from home, which is much different than it was 15 years ago, and people being more flexible where they can live. So that's changing the dynamics of things. You've got the CFPB, since they got implemented, a lot tighter on restrictions, stealing years ago. So I'll stop right now.
You can do your take. I'll do my take. Go ahead.
Part of it is you can compare things to learn from them, but at the end of the day, my focus is on what's going on right now, what are we forecasting or looking to see, and how are we structuring our business to be able to be profitable and take advantage of some of the things that we see coming down the path in front of us.
Yeah, I would say that for me, when I look at that and then versus now, I guess you could say, it was like bad lending practice induced. And people, like you said, were not qualified to be owning the homes they owned, which led to 07-08. But now, and then the CFPB came in and made much, and for people who don't know, that is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, correct?
Nailed
it, always. Anyways, placed a lot more regulations and restrictions around who could invest in notes, who could be lending, what it means to be a lender, and certain guidelines and restrictions. That's why we have licensed servicers in every state that we work with. Again, just to make sure that our investors' equity is protected and we're following everything to a T. So now, though, it's not that the loans or the notes that we're acquiring are necessarily people who couldn't afford it. It was more a situational change for them, whether that was health, divorce, job issue. So at some point they were qualified to afford the home. It's more what changed in their situation. Mm-hmm. And like, how can 7E step in? And again, because we do have such a price discount on what we're acquiring the loan for, how can we work with them? How can we get this loan reperforming? And one thing I wanted to touch on is you say, oh, we hold notes for anywhere from 18 to 24 months. Yes, that's not saying that's how long it takes to get this borrower back on track. I just wanted to clarify that. Typically, it does not take that nearly that long, but the goal is to get it to perform and then season the loan to be able to then sell it as a performing loan.
Yeah, that was a good point about 18 to 24 months.
Yeah.
One thing that I know you get asked a lot and I get asked a lot as well, and both of us also are investors in different things, real estate, whatever the case may be. What are some of the things that you're doing or people around you or people you've discussed with? What are some of the things people are doing? Because that's, I think, another question besides, okay, there's a 7E fund. If someone said, okay, Lauren, what should I be doing? And again, we're not giving quote unquote financial advice. We're talking about some of the things that we may be doing with our portfolio based off of some of the things that we see, because I think we're very tight knit to the mortgage market and housing. I live, breathe, and read everything between that and reading SEC offerings and other things that I like to do that you realize. So what are some of the things that you look for?
You and I are going to have very different answers to this. No, similar answers along what we look for. But when I'm having discussions,
I'm a lot older.
Yeah.
You just want to say that.
I don't want to say it, but I'll say it. No, but it's good. Essentially, number one, looking at investing in things that are secured, that where you have secured assets that are not over leveraged. That's specific to like real estate funds, any kind of syndication, not over leveraged, secured assets, top two things. As a whole, the conversations I'm having are for with a lot of people who come from that tech, heavily invested in stock. And so they're looking and trying to get out of that and realizing that they do want to get into something that is more secured, that is not necessarily at the whim of up and down and taking a hit hard today. A lot of people that are my peers, my contemporaries, again, I come from the Silicon Valley tech startup world. That is my background before real estate. So they're all looking to diversify and get into more real estate backed or secured assets as far as investments go.
So a few things that I'm looking for and things I'm not looking to invest in. Okay. Both. I've got some real estate rentals in my portfolio, which keeping those, they're cash flowing, they're doing well. Of course, some notes we love as well. A few things that, again, I've never got into crypto and I don't intend on it at this point in time. It's just something that, again, to me isn't tangible. A few things that I've invested in the past, I'm taking a harder look at. One is multifamily syndication.
To clarify, taking a harder look at as in investing. Being more cautious.
More cautious for my personal investment. And I'm being cautious because A, I spent many years working in that space and the deals are really pretty much come to a halt because interest rates are above cap rates. So it's your bar previously, if an interest rate was at 3% or 4%, your cap rate's at 5, you'd leverage it and it would enhance your returns. Now, when your interest rate's above the cap rates, it actually hinders your returns. But the other thing with multifamily that has me slightly concerned is a lot of those exit strategies are based on like a 5-year refinance. And you really want to look at where those refinances could be because you and I have had this discussion and I'll let you give your opinion on where you think interest rates will be. But some people think, in 6 months, interest rates will be back down to 3%. And I would love that. But reality is, I don't think that's happening, but I'll let you voice your opinion. Between that and then again, it goes back to rent rates and rent continues to go up, but eventually there's that breaking point where it just gets too unaffordable. And when you look at, again, inflation, which is still roaring at 7.5%. I heard a great analogy of, great, it went down, but you're still going 150 miles on the highway when it's 65. It went from 180 to 150, but you're still speeding. You got to remember that a good component of that is wages. And to bring that down, if wages come down, where there's already 24 million people that can't afford a house, that same house 6 months ago. So there's a lot to digest with that. But it's one of those things where I'm looking on the multifamily side and it's one asset versus a fund with 20 of them. And it's something that's looking to be acquired now. Make sure you understand the fundamentals and the numbers behind it. And the ones that I've seen today, I think they're a little too aggressive on some of the exit rates.
Yeah. And I'd say something else when you're looking at kind of investment strategy during a downturn is much more research. And we've done, I think, 3 or 4 podcast episodes on this, on the sponsors, like strategy, previous funds, current investments. Again, if you are listening to this for the first time and haven't listened to our podcast, highly recommend checking it out. We've gone through questions you should be ready to ask your sponsor. Chris has answered all of those questions. And then top questions I get asked when speaking with current or potential investors on the phone. Feel free to check out those episodes. We talk all about that. But yeah, I think to echo all the things you said, but also you talk about interest rates. A lot of people, I see people investing with like ARM loans and thinking, oh, okay, yeah, like I'll refinance in, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, and it gives me a little bit of anxiety. That's probably going to be, typically it's about 6 years is the average it takes. But when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking like probably I don't have a crystal ball. I can't predict what's going to happen in the future, but I feel like it's going to we were in this market for this great market for so long. I feel like it's going to take probably, I'd say 5 to 10 years to come back down. Again, I'm no crystal ball here, just based on experience and what I've seen the market do before.
It's interesting because So the story of with time and price, it's like fishing. Oh yeah, that fish, every year that fish you caught got 6 inches bigger. Housing, the same thing. Everyone's like, oh my God, my house lost 50%. No, it probably didn't back then. And also people are like, oh, inflation went from here down to here in 2 years. You actually go back and look at the figures again. Basically, I think it was like 78 to 80 or something like that, where it went from 7 up to double digits. To get back below 3, even when it got up to like 5, I think in 1992, still took 4 years just to get below 3. And if they want to target 2%, that's a whole nother animal, but it's slow. They have the means to get there. It'll be interesting because they had quantitative easing a decade ago. Now they're doing the QT. It's the first time it's ever being done. So there's a lot going into the mix with the markets and so forth. But at the end of the day, it's just so unpredictable because we're in a global economy and there's so much that can be impacted based globally as well as internally within what the federal government can and can't do.
Yeah. And I think that one thing also to consider is, again, coming back to that strategy and not giving financial advice, just again, that disclaimer out there, not a financial advisor, like time, and then realizing that the returns of the past decade have been astronomical, especially the last few years when it came to like real estate specifically. You could essentially put your money in any real estate investment 2020.
Or stock, essentially.
Yeah, or stock, literally. You could just set your money in something in the start of 2020. And at the end of 2021, you're like, wow, I am a genius. I have made the best investments. Not necessarily the case. And I think we're going to see a lot of people realize that. Adjusting your expectations of, I speak with investors, some of them I get on the phone with, and they say they're looking for 15, 20% return. I have others who say, oh my gosh, how can you possibly offer 8%? So I think it's also just knowing realistically what you can expect in this market for the assets you're investing in. If you're not taking that on yourself, obviously, if you're doing this yourself, it's a very different.
Yeah. And one of the things we, I think, pride ourselves on is understanding risk and being able to measure it. People talk about, oh, this person's offering 20% or whatever is people throw out there. You have to understand there's always some risk associated with that return that parallels that. And as I've spoken a million times to this as a note investor and real estate investor, is we look to target, I'm going to use the baseball analogy, singles and doubles. If you're in football, we run 7 to 12 yard out patterns. Once in a while, do we go for a home run? Sometimes we get them, but rarely do we ever strike out because that's not what we look for. I know some people who, especially back in the day, were buying second mortgages that were 100% underwater. And basically what that meant is house was worth $500,000, the first mortgage was $600,000, and they were still owed $100,000. And they would buy 100 of them and they pay 5 cents on a dollar for them, hoping that one person would cut them a check. And they, some of them would get that one person that would cut them the check that paid for all those other loans and everything else. It's almost like buying a scratch ticket is what that was. To me, I view that more as gambling. Yeah. As a note investor, we like to look at the strategy. And yes, there's used term game theory involved with trying to understand the borrower. And that's where we talk about that 3D picture, which you can talk about a little more. But, you know, that's the one thing that we strive ourselves and pride ourselves on is understanding the risk that's in the type of investments that we're looking at.
Yeah. As you said, again, it always happens. I'm like, oh, I'm going to say something. Oh, and then he says it. Yeah. I think that and just like being very realistic about, and I always say we under promise, over deliver. Mm-hmm. And if you go, and I've had people mention this before, oh, I was on Bigger Pockets and I was looking at Chris, or I was Googling Chris and who Chris is. And seems like he has, people have nothing but great things to say. And I think part of that is just like, we are very transparent and realistic about what is possible and are always under promising and over delivering on our communication, our returns, and the investor experience overall. So I think that's something that, not to toot our own horn, but I think, well, yours really, you do a good job of.
But toot my own horn, thank you.
But we did set aside half an hour for this podcast episode, but I do want to open it up. One of the benefits of having a live podcast episode is that we do have people here listening. So if anyone wants to throw a question into the Q&A, or anything like that, feel free. I'll give you a few seconds here to do that. Happy to answer questions on the fly. Again, this will be posted to our podcast for people to hear, re-listen to, share with a friend, whatever that might be. But again, the purpose of this episode was really to talk about the market, all the things we're hearing, a lot of it is around values dropping, obviously, because that mostly correlates to what we do. So I think there was that concern. Hopefully we've addressed that. We just got a comment.
And again, it goes back to, thank you for that comment, by the way, the weathering the storm that a lot of people are seeing and buckling down the hatches and focusing on the business. And one thing that I think also about us is we're also very strategic in that we're not trying to dip our toes in many different things, or we're not shifting businesses. I see a lot of people sometimes will get into kind of the game of chase and start chasing things or chasing returns. That's, again, that's not something that we do. And with our business, we are very focused on what we target, and we look at our buy box. And is it adjusting? Of course it is. Adjust things, but pivot on some items. But we're, again, very strategic.
We're not going to go and start buying seconds, is essentially is what you're saying. We're not going to try to reinvent.
Credit card debt. All of a sudden, credit card debt's at $1 trillion. And you can go buy credit card debt. Oh, all of a sudden, there's loans in Greece. I see people chasing loans in Greece. Car loans. I see people chasing that. I see people wanting to get into short-term rentals because that's the next big component. So we're, I'll say, very strategic in regards to our business plan, which, again, we had to be anyways with the offering that we had to submit on. What are your final thoughts, Lauren?
My final thoughts. Just final thoughts would be making sure that when, one, who you're investing with. To me, someone I was speaking with yesterday said this, and maybe it sounds cheesy, but I agree with him. I think who you invest with is as important as the asset you're investing in. The people, their experience, your experience working with them. So I'd say getting to know the team behind the assets you're investing in is important. So that would be one piece of advice I have. And then making sure that you are investing in securitized assets. Right now, specifically, I would not be putting a ton of money, if we're looking at like portfolios as a whole, I would not necessarily be moving too much of my money out of the stock market. Granted, again, I have a little bit more time than you, Chris. But I would also, and I wouldn't be looking at like short-term rentals, like you said, or fix and flips. But yeah, what is going to be like a stable bread and butter income generating investment over the next several years? So those are my final thoughts.
I'll add a few things for us. Again, this is just my personal, again, looking back for me personally, I'm not trying to chase returns right now or chase things with very high returns, because those are going to pose a much higher risk, especially if credit starts tightening. Investments where, and again, something securitized or a lot of cash, companies with cash, and provide a service or have cash flow, I think is very important as well to look at the underlying company in itself, because I think a lot of companies over the last 5 or 6 years have also been propped up by VC firms, as an example.
Yeah.
And once some of that, can they survive on their own, and what's that management look like?
Yeah. Or are these companies taking additional leverage outside of, I think that's important too, which if you're comfortable with, that's fine. But personally, I would not be.
Yeah, and that's actually one thing, and I know we're running a little late, that we didn't really touch upon, I think we should, is, again, with our fund, when people talk, do you leverage? We are the bank. So we don't secure or obtain additional leverage with our funds.
Can you explain, example, for people who might not understand how that term, what that means?
Yeah. So again, we'll go back to traditional real estate, and I'm just going to use banks, for example, no representation of these banks, but let's say you're buying a $500,000 property with 20% down. So you're putting $100,000 down. You're getting a $400,000 mortgage from Wells Fargo. So you're leveraged, or meaning you owe Wells Fargo $400,000. So it goes back to, if pricing does come down, you're at the mercy of the bank. Essentially, if you can't make payments, or you borrowed that money, so you still owe that money out there. And that's traditional real estate. Basically, we're filling in for, we are the Wells Fargo. So we don't have loans from Wells Fargo, PNC, TD, pick a bank. We have you know, our shareholders that basically are the investment. So if markets, something does tighten or we do take a property back, it's not, oh, we have to liquidate this because we have a bank calling us. We can turn that into a rental. We can hold it, turn it into a rental. We could turn around and sell that property. We could turn around, sell it, seller financing. We could sell the note. There's many different components that allow us, by not having the leverage, be able to be much more flexible. And you can say that in 5 words. I know you can. So why don't you?
No, I asked you on purpose because someone sent me a private message about that. So I wanted to make sure that concept was broken down a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other, we could go in. I think we actually have a whole other podcast episode about debt and leverage. So again, go back, listen to that episode if you want to learn more about that. But if, do you have any other final thoughts?
I was just going to say, with real estate, most people get themselves in trouble because they're over leveraged.
Yes.
You know, and that's where you see most investors get themselves in trouble, is because they've over leveraged and they can't afford the payments or values decrease. And they're basically chasing their dollar and it basically runs out. So I think that's something just I want to mention about leverage as well.
Awesome. Perfect. I don't have any other final thoughts. If anyone is interested in learning more about our offering, we are offering, again, I'd be happy to get on a call with you. Feel free to email me directly at invest@70investments.com or give me a call and we can talk about our offering, which offers 8% annually paid in monthly dividends and is open to accredited and non-accredited investors. Anything to add, Chris?
Bonus shares.
Oh, the minimum investment is $500 with bonus shares starting at $25,000. So interested, want to connect about the offering, notes specifically, or anything of that, feel free to reach out to me directly. With that being said, thank you guys so much for joining us today on this live episode of the CWS podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a review. Until next time, thanks guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.